All right, repeat after me. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day, for those gathered here and those far away, for the time we share with love and care. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day.
Good morning, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, a congregation of seekers bound together by our common humanity. My name is Kelly Richardson McBee, and along with my husband, Stephen McBee, we will be convening this morning's service. I'd like to open with an adaptation of piece reading number 416. Holy and beautiful the custom which brings us together in the presence of the Most High, to face and affirm our ideals, to remember loved ones in absence, to give thanks, to admit our shortcomings, to offer forgiveness, to be enlightened, and to be strengthened. Through this quiet hour, breathe the worship of ages, the cathedral music of history. Three unseen guests attend, faith, hope, and love. Let all our hearts prepare them place.
At this time, please refer to your order of service for announcements. At this time, does anyone have any other additional announcements to make? Also, everyone is please invited to stay after the service for the group potluck in the main room. Okay. This morning, I would like to invite our new family from Fort Riley, the Hills, to come up and join me at the podium. They're going to join us for our chalice lighting this morning. As we get ready to lead into Memorial Day starting tomorrow, it is time that we give thanks and we remember our fallen service members, men and women who gave their lives for us here back in the States to continue our way of life. As we light the chalice and fully embrace the sacred space created here this morning, please hold in your hearts the Unitarian Universalist principle, which calls upon us to respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Today, as we remember those who share this earth with us no longer and bear witness to their lives and the roles they have played in ours, we pay homage to and make stronger that web which connects us all. Thank you very much. Please rise in body or spirit and join us in singing our opening hymn, number 300, with heart and mind. Thank you very much. We come now to a time of sharing the passages of our life As joys shared are joys multiplied, and burdens shared are burdens halved. If you have a joy, sorrow, or milestone to share, please share them now.
In L. Forrester, it gives me great pleasure that my son and daughter are here visiting today. And they're from the Topeka Fellowship, 30-some years now in membership, though via Alexandria, Virginia. But also a great celebration. Many years ago, on Memorial Day, I labored, and my son's birthday today.
Hi, Ann Marchin, and I'm lucky enough to have my daughter Marjorie and her husband Aaron visiting here from Kansas City. And my son is now currently at home mowing my grass, and then he's taken off for Lawrence, so it's been a great weekend for me. But I'm also listing my house on Friday, so they're helping me get organized because I'm going to get rid of some of that extra space, finally, I hope.
Well, it seems to be son and daughter announcement day, so I was just going to announce that my daughter Clara is working at the hospital on Sunday mornings from 8 to 12 this summer. So you won't be seeing her here much, but she will miss you.
And before we close out then, a lot of you guys have commented or reacted on my Facebook post, and I appreciate that. This Monday, I lost two very good friends, one of whom I graduated with out of high school, and his younger brother in a plane crash in Hawaii. They were visiting their father and going skydiving, and the plane didn't survive. So any thoughts and prayers you could send to their mother, Laura, would be great. Thank you very much.
For all these joys and sorrows and others left unsaid, we come together now and ask our beloved community to keep them in their hearts, thoughts, and prayers. Now we've got the story for all ages, so little people and not so little people, come on up. Oh, you're not so little. Medium-sized, big people. Wow. Good morning. Everybody looks really happy. School's out, isn't it? Almost? Yeah. Your school's out? Today we're going to be reading a story called The Poppy Lady. And the poppy right here is a symbol of Memorial Day and of remembering our veterans. And this is the story of how the poppy came to be that way. It's the story of Moina Bell Michael and her quest to and her tribute to veterans. March 1917, German U-boats sunk another American ship, and the nation was outraged. Would the president call for war? Would Congress agree? Moina Bell Michael prayed not. She had toured Europe when war first broke out. Oh, well, come here, sweetheart. Oh, come here. Come help me turn the page. Here. Moina Bell Michael prayed not. She had been touring Europe when war first broke out in the summer of 1914. Okay, turn the page. But now, bomb craters, trenches, barbed wire fences, and battlefields covered the countryside, visions that still made her shudder. April 1917. The paper boy wheeled his bicycle across the University of Georgia's Normal School, slamming the brakes when he reached Moina. Moina snatched the Athens banner away from him, struck by the headline, Wilson asking for war. All night long, Moina called the Athens banner. Each time, she was told to be patient. The president was still talking to Congress. At 10:30 p.m., she called again. Tell the young ladies to say their prayers, go to bed, and to sleep, the frustrated editor replied. Before dawn, the edition arrived. Moina read Wilson's inspiring plea to defend democracy, defend the rights of small nations, and defend the freedom of the seas. America was going to war. Moina vowed to do everything she could for the soldiers to remember them. Okay, can you sit down now? Here. You stand right here. Here, here's your kitty. Here, now turn the page, please. Thank you for your patience. Moina knitted socks and sweaters, rolled bandages for the Red Cross, and when friends enlisted and students came by to say goodbye, she gave them a little remembrance to take overseas. But Moina wanted to do something more. She delivered books, magazines, and candy to their camps nearby. She and friends invited soldiers to come for dinner. Can you turn the page?
You did it this page.
Oh, I'm sorry, sweetheart. Hold on one moment. Scotty, can you go with Daddy?
No!
Come on.
No!
We're sorry. And when it came time for the soldiers to leave, Moina went to the train station to see them off. But Moina wanted to do even more. To become a worker at the canteen for the YMCA and help soldiers overseas seemed perfect. She could listen to them about their family and serve men on leave from the battlefields. She successfully completed the course to do so, but was told she was too old at age 49 to go overseas. Moina refused to give up, but what could she do now? Help the soldiers before they left for war. Moina set up a desk in the basement of Columbia Hamilton Hall, where soldiers, sailors, Marines, and secretaries came during their free time. But as winter approached, the large room began to turn gloomy and gray. The soldiers deserved a brighter, more comfortable place. Moina knew what to do. With her small salary, Moina bought fresh flowers and placed them all over the room. But she wanted to do even more. On Sunday morning, a soldier left a magazine at her desk. Moina turned to the page to find We Will Not Sleep, also known as In Flanders Fields, by Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, a Canadian physician. She had read the poem many times, but she read it again, touched by McCrae's tribute to the soldiers that he could not save on the battlefield of Flanders. The poem was most strikingly illustrated in color. Spirits of soldiers floated above the battleground covered in white crosses and bright red poppies. There were no names on these crosses, no memories, no memory of who rested beneath the red poppies, and Moina knew what she had to do. To Moina, the silent thought of voices came again. They were vocal, whispering. She thought of friends, students, and the soldiers at the Y, and knew that she could not forget them. Moina turned over an envelope and wrote a pledge, ending with a promise, and this is what she wrote. And now the torch and poppy read, "We wear in honor of our dead. Fear not, ye who have died in for naught. We'll teach the lesson that we wrought in Flanders fields." Moina knew what she had to do. With her $10 check, she announced, "I shall buy poppies. I will always wear poppies, red poppies for the poppies of Flanders Field." Moina went poppy hunting in the streets of New York, and at last, in Wanamaker's department store, she found one large and 24 small silk poppies. Moina pinned the large one on her cloak and went back to the Y. It was evening, and the room was quiet. Moina placed the red poppy in the vase on her desk and handed out the 23 smaller ones to men and women leaving for France. She watched as they pinned them on her uniforms. Still, Moina wanted and needed to do more. She would not stop until every American wore a poppy to remember the soldiers always. And these are poppies. And every so often, You'll see veterans at supermarkets and at gas stations handing out poppies. Yeah. In remembrance of those who perished in World War I. And that's how we became, that's how the poppy became the symbol to remember our veterans. Have a wonderful day today and have fun.
As we prepare to take this morning's offering, may each of us look into not just our pocketbooks to see how much we have with us. Let us look into our hearts as well and see what is available there. How much love, how much generosity, how much faith, how much gratitude, how much hope. And let us take our offering from that account. For the gifts which we have received and the gifts which we ourselves are, may we be truly grateful. Now I'd like to share with you the poem In Flanders Fields by Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae. In Flanders Fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly. Scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead short days ago. We lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow. Loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw. The torch be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep though poppies grow in Flanders Fields.
This next piece is called The Buddhist Tobacco by Major George Tiger, who's a chaplain in the U.S. Army. I lean back in the chair and exhale a long breath of thick, wide cigar smoke into the night sky. It rises upward, swirls in a light breeze, and disappears. Think to myself, damn, this is a good cigar, a good night, and a good place to be for these few moments. Earlier today, I walked through the bazaar where merchants sell overpriced knickknacks from Pakistan and Chinese designer knockoff watches. I held my hand out to one of the kids running around, and he latched onto it and used it like a swing. I lifted him high up off the ground, just as my son does. He laughed, and he swung as I carried him around. It lasted just a moment, but it was a nearly perfect moment in an imperfect place. Moments are all we have, moments of laughter, moments of relaxation, moments to be alive. It can be hard finding anything good about being in a war zone. It is hot, it's dirty, it smells bad. There is a constant threat of IEDs or improvised explosive devices or whatever insane system someone has devised to maim or kill other human beings. Then there is the daily grind of guard duty and details that can feel overwhelming, never ending. As the sweet smoke disappears, it reminds me that none of this, the smells, the sights, the sound, the danger, and the grind, none of it is permanent. Maybe the last moment was a bad one. Maybe the next one will hold something unwanted. But the present moment can be a good one if we are present to experience it. How many moments will you spend somewhere where you'd rather not be? How many moments will you really live wherever you are? These are two different questions. If we spend all of our moments in regret or worry, if we see the bad in it all, then the moments will grind by one bad day after another. And we won't really be living, but existing, waiting for real life to begin. But real life is here, and it is now. Whatever the conditions may be, there is goodness to be found, even if it comes in small moments. A moment with a good cigar, a moment playing with a child, a moment with friends. Moment by moment, we live our lives. Like smoke rising into the sky, each moment will fade away into the next, and the next, and the next, and the next. Will you be present for the next moment of your life? It's always up to you. Now I'd like to present Stefan, who's going to give a brief reflection on Memorial Day.
Good morning. Everyone knows that tomorrow is Memorial Day, but few people know how it actually came to be. The very first Memorial Day is credited in Charleston, South Carolina, on May 1st in 1865, where over 250 Union POWs died and were buried hastily in unmarked graves. Black residents, along with teachers and missionaries, came together to clean and landscape that burial area and erected an enclosure and an arch with the words "Martyrs of the Race Course." On May 1st, nearly 10,000 people, mostly freedmen, gathered to commemorate the war dead. Involved were about 3,000 school children, newly enrolled in freedmen's schools, as well as mutual aid societies, Union troops, black ministers, and white northern missionaries. Most brought flowers to lay at the burial field. Professor David William Blight, a professor of American history at Yale University and director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition, described this day as the first Memorial Day. African Americans invented Memorial Day in Charleston, South Carolina. What you have there is black Americans recently freed from slavery, announcing to the world with their flowers, their feet, and their songs that what the war had been about. What they basically were creating was the Independence Day of a second American Revolution. But he also states that he has no evidence that this event inspired the establishment of Memorial Day nationwide. On May 5th, 1868, General John A. Logan, as Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic, the Veterans Organization for the Union Civil War Veterans, issued a proclamation calling for Decoration Day to be observed annually and nationwide. It was observed on May 30th, a Saturday, because it wasn't an anniversary for any particular Civil War battle. The preferred name for the holiday gradually changed from Decoration Day to Memorial Day, which was first used in 1882. It did not become more common until after World War II and was not declared the official name by federal law until 1967. On June 28, 1968, the Congress passed the Uniform Monday Holiday Act, which moved four holidays, including Memorial Day, from their traditional dates to a specified Monday in order to create a convenient three-day weekend. On Memorial Day, the flag of the United States is briskly raised to the top of the staff and solemnly lowered to the half-staff position, where it remains only until noon. It is then raised to full staff for the remainder of the day. The half-staff position remembers the more than 1 million men and women who gave their lives in sacrifice of their country. At noon, their memory is raised by the living, who resolve not to let their sacrifice be in vain, but to rise up in their stead and continue the fight for liberty and justice for all. In 1915, following the Second Battle of Ypres, Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, a physician of the Canadian Expeditionary Force, wrote the poem In Flanders Field. Its opening lines refer to the fields of poppies that grew among the soldiers' graves in Flanders. In 1918, inspired by the poem, YWCA worker Moina Michael attended a YWCA Overseas War Secretary's conference wearing a silk poppy pinned to her coat and distributed over two dozen more to others present. In 1920, the National American Legion adopted it as their official symbol of remembrance. Now we have some special music from World War I genre called Sergeant Mackenzie, also known as Les Midun.
Please rise in body and spirit and join us for singing hymn number 119, Every Soul and Every Nation.
I grew up in a military family. From an early age, I encountered a patriotism that was religious in its fervor. Before I started school, I learned the Marine Corps hymn. Did I mention patriotism religious in its fervor? I pictured Marines marching from halls in some big palace in a place named Montezuma to some other place called Tripoli, neither of which I had any idea what they were or where they were or what they were about, and later found myself embarrassed by my childish misconceptions. Montezuma was a person in the Mexican-American War, and Tripoli was on the other side of the ocean where you couldn't march to. And the two wars were decades apart. But even at four, I knew it involved adventure, commitment, and swagger. And that was great. On the other hand, even at an early age, I knew that death was involved. The flag, folded neatly and liturgically presented at veterans' funerals and displayed in many relatives' homes like an altar. The long, straight lines of marble headstones in Arlington Cemetery with miniature flags stuck in the ground by each one for Memorial Day holiday. The rousing brass and drums punctuating the patriotic songs played for the occasion. Death cleansed of its messiness. War of its anguish. And it didn't take me long to learn a bit about the messiness and anguish. I grew up watching the newsreels from Vietnam. Maybe Vietnam was no messier or unethical or destructive than any other war, but never before, and I would argue since either, did a war enter our living rooms bursting with the blood and mud and chaos that Vietnam did, accompanied by the soundtrack of Country Joe and the Fish. 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. War, if nothing else, is complicated. I want to remind you, too, that despite appearances, we are at war and have been for the last 15 years without a break. And unlike traditional wars, it's hard to say exactly who we are at war against or where. War has usually been between nations, and what does it mean to be fighting terrorist organizations with and without permission of the countries where they live? Are drone strikes in Pakistan part of a war? How are we involved in Syria? The war on terror seems to be all over the place, and the target keeps shifting. The administration claims our troops are not part of combat operations, yet they still die and come home maimed or battle-scarred. There's no declared war, so we haven't talked about it or debated the wisdom of going to war, yet we keep paying for it. Financially, Congress authorizes the money, and we keep paying for it in all the other ways, too, including deaths, with 3 killed already in Afghanistan this year, 22 last year, 55 in 2014, and we are killing more than we are being killed. So, yes, we are at war. We just don't talk about it anymore. The armed forces know it. It's the rest of us who are out of the loop. With the decreasing percentages of Americans associated with the military, many of us can remain blissfully unaware. What better time than Memorial Day to remember? Our nation began in war. We Americans seem convinced that freedom is deeply tied up with combat. It has been since 1776, since the American Revolution. 1.3 million Americans have died in war. That number is huge, shocking, really. That's the size of San Diego or Dallas. It is these people who are honored and remembered on Memorial Day. They fought in any number of conflicts, the Revolution itself, the various wars against the Indian nations, the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, the Philippine-American War, the Boxer Rebellion, occupations of Haiti and Nicaragua, World War I, the North Russia campaign, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, El Salvador, Beirut, Grenada, Panama, the Gulf War, Somalia, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Iraq. I left out a few. Total, though, is 1.3 million people whose lives were lost in or related to combat. And I can't help but wonder if we Americans are more ready than others to engage in war because our nation was born in war, It's a habit. Now, I could talk about the imperialism inherent in many of those wars, especially the Indian Wars, but today is not the time for that. I want to acknowledge, though, that we Americans fight a lot of wars. It is really a human thing, though. Historian Will Durant claims that throughout history there have been only 29 years when there wasn't a war going on somewhere. Only 29 years of worldwide peace. And those weren't consecutive. It's a sad record. Too often I've witnessed Memorial Day observances that offer a romanticized version of war, all cleaned up like those neat rows of headstones, stories of heroism recited, flags fluttering, patriotic songs sung, and we feel better because we have done something. We know we owe these dead soldiers something and aren't really sure what to offer because they have given the ultimate, their lives, and what can you do to make up for that? I'd like to honor the dead with a little more realism, to admit the messiness of it, to acknowledge that war does not produce heroes as often as it produces fear and trauma, to remind us of the true depth of the sacrifices. Nationalists often don't want to hear the truth because it runs counter to the myth of war. War correspondent Chris Hedges wrote a book in 2002, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and talked about the myth of war, a myth that breaks down when confronted by the reality on the battlefield, a confrontation that most of us manage to spend our lives avoiding. War, he writes, is messy, confusing, sullied by raw brutality, and an elephantine fear that grabs us like a massive bouncer who comes up from behind. Soldiers in the moment before real battles weep, vomit, and write last letters home. All are nearly paralyzed with fright. There is a morbid silence that grips a battlefield in the final moments before the shooting starts, one that sets the back of my own head pounding with pain, wipes away all appetite, and makes my fingers tremble as I ready myself to go forward against logic. No one ever charges into battle for God and country. Hedges describes how the myth of war creates a drama that romanticizes the purpose and the events, how war correspondents like him feed into that romance and deception. People need this because to face what war really does, the death, the destruction, the catastrophe we unleash on the world, is really difficult. If myth can paper over the reality, it becomes easier to stand to go to war. Now, I have a colleague who rants about the importance of keeping Memorial Day as a recognition of those who have died and not of those who serve or have served in the military. And while I concede his point about the main focus of Memorial Day, I also recognize that many soldiers have experienced little deaths that must also be noted. Soldiers who return without legs or arms, who retreat into alcohol or drugs as they face an inability to process the trauma they have endured, who shoot themselves, because that is usually the suicide method of choice of soldiers. They may not be the proper honorees of Memorial Day, but when else will they be remembered? The VA reports that 22 veterans a day commit suicide. Now, that's more than just veterans of recent wars. It includes veterans of Vietnam, for example, who, as they age, find life offers them less and less, and they have not yet escaped the torment they lived through. I remember volunteering at an annual homeless count a few years ago. Interviewing one man, I asked the routine question of how long had he lived on the streets. His answer surprised me. "I got back from Vietnam in 72, he said. Ever since then, the scars are long-lasting. Interestingly, recent veterans are more likely to commit suicide if they were not deployed than if they were. That reminds us again of the complexity of war and what we are asking of the people who fight it. The toll that war takes is huge on service members. I remember another Vietnam veteran who rarely left his home, always sat with his back to the wall when he did. His life may not technically have ended in the war, and he was never homeless. He was married, but he was unemployed due to his disability from PTSD. Life had narrowed from a broad swath of possibility to a narrow ribbon of regularity, and that was the only way he could live. The ubiquity of death in war can threaten our human reactions to it. In normal life, we encounter death occasionally. We all come across it as part of our human experience. And when we do, we generally have time to process each death that comes, to value the humanity and individuality of the person who died. And though young people do die outside of war, most often our experience of mortality in normal life is the death of our elders, of people who have lived 7 or 8 decades and experienced what there is of life. The deaths of young soldiers in war are different from normal. Like any death of a young person, they come out of time, out of the natural order that we imagine to exist. But there's another factor at war, at work here, another factor. Death is not uncommon in war. It happens routinely. Death is the aim of war. And there's a human need to say, stop! Look! Someone has died. Died before their time. Died in service to something larger than themselves. Died perhaps in our place. Our human need is to acknowledge the reality of death in the inhuman, death-soaked reality of war. Death reminds us that the proper response to war is always grief. Not only is life destroyed, but also truth, said to be the first casualty of war. And if Hedges is right, culture and history as well. The myths of war, he says, that it is romantic and stirring and adventurous, undermine culture, replacing it with nationalistic stirrings, and distort history, misrepresenting the enemy, excusing our side's mistakes, and sometimes even brutality, and failing to accurately report objective facts. And while all this is true, there remains another facet. We are in debt to those 1.3 million who have died in combat, and to the others whose graves host flags this weekend, my father and brother and grandfather among them, and to those whose graves will someday sport those flags, including some of you here today. They're asked to go to war, or to be prepared to defend the nation. They were asked to represent us. We may or may not have agreed that a particular war deserved our participation. We may or may not have understood how their particular actions protected our freedom. We may not believe that they did. That does not take away the reality that they were there for us in our stead. How is that debt to be repaid? Too often in the world's history, the response to war dead has been vengeance. So many conflicts from India and Pakistan, Ireland, Israel, and Palestine. The deaths on each side have fueled fighting, kept the troops and politicians enraged enough to strive to inflict as much pain as they felt. wars recurring over generations. And America has not been immune to that effect. The wars against Indian nations were nudged along by stories, usually exaggerated, of white deaths that precipitated exaggerated vengeance. I think our reluctance to leave Vietnam, even as the war was failing, was in part a sense of vengeance, a feeling that we can't let them get away with this. The war on terror may also be a war of vengeance as much as a strategic effort to prevent further outrages, because how, after all, does one wage a war against a crime of intimidation? Do we even know how to have that kind of war? Of course, vengeance is not a legitimate aim of warfare. And that has often been recognized among civilized nations. Philosophers expound and spin out just war theories and other rationales, but generally recognize that giving in to the urge for vengeance violates our humanity. Just war theory includes the idea that a war can be not only in self-defense, but also to redress a wrong, and that has some ambiguity to it. We humans often claim self-defense when the truth is that we want revenge, but know that it's wrong to seek it. Nations should come up with some more reasonable reason than vengeance to inflict the pain of war. Tit for tat will never bring peace. Or as Gandhi famously said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. We know vengeance exacts too great a toll on us as well as our enemy. So if not vengeance, what does honoring the dead require of us? If I were to speak of how we honor those who did not die in war, I would speak of the need to keep our promises to them, to compensate them adequately, to provide for them and their families. But it is, as my colleague would remind me, Memorial Day, not Veterans Day, and today we are most concerned with those who have died. That's not too much of a leap to guess that those who have died would want us to keep those promises to the living, to ensure that soldiers' families need not rely on food stamps, that veterans receive quality health care they've been promised, particularly when their complaints come directly from the service which they provided. But let me get to those ways of honoring that are more relevant to those who have died. There are three suggestions that I have. I'd start with honesty. I think we owe the dead honesty. Honesty about their deaths and the circumstances of them. Honesty about our reasons for war and what was and was not accomplished. Brutal honesty about the costs of war, more than the economic costs, the costs in lives lost to death and also to decimation. Recognition that the toll includes people, real people with real lives from the enemy side. On Friday, President Obama visited Peace Memorial Park in Hiroshima, an historic acknowledgement of the horrors of one particularly cruel form of war. That visit marked an honest recognition of the harm that had been done by the atomic bomb. It wasn't the apology that some Japanese wanted, but that many Americans, much less the Chinese, would never accept. He did, though, listen to survivors and hear something of the anguish caused by an act of war perpetrated by our nation. "We are called," he said, "to moral revolution, a push to eliminate the possibility of use of nuclear weapons." He added that plenty of destruction happens with much less technological weaponry, and mentioned that we must change our mindset about war itself. Even the VFW issued a statement that a world without conflict is a vision we should all share. It reminds me of words Bertrand Russell wrote in 1915 in the context of World War I. "Our sympathy," he wrote, with Belgium should make us hate war rather than Germany. After honesty, the second way to honor the war dead is to remember them for who they were. For example, last December, a suicide bombing in Afghanistan made the news, by now long forgotten by most of us. But American soldiers died there. Joseph Lem, serving in the Air National Guard, was killed. Born in Nebraska, a 15-year veteran with NYPD, nicknamed Superman, in part because he was 6'4", a gentle giant, people said, afraid only of snakes. Leaving a wife, a 17-year-old daughter, and a 4-year-old son. The same incident killed Air Force Major Adriana Verdenbrunger from Plymouth, Minnesota. 36, she was the first openly gay Air Force officer to die in combat. She fought for years to get the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy repealed and later married her partner. She, too, had a 4-year-old and a wife. Also a father whose wife was expecting another child, a young staff sergeant assigned to the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, another staff sergeant on his 4th tour of duty to Afghanistan. Real people, real lives torn from them. We forget so soon. Though some people cannot forget, the man who the president hugged at the Hiroshima ceremony, Shigeyuki Mori, has his own history. He survived the atomic bomb because the blast knocked him off a bridge into a little river as he was walking to school. He was only 8 years old then. And he saw American POWs near his school, which had been completely destroyed, his school. And affected by his own history, researching the bombing became an avocation. And when he ended up with a list of American airmen who had been held prisoner in Hiroshima, he researched them, combing borrowed American phone books and making calls. For 20 years, he searched for relatives of these dead enemies. In time, American government documents were declassified and confirmed what he had learned. The names of those airmen are now listed at the Hiroshima Memorial, thanks to Mori. That effort honored the dead. Particularly touching was that the effort came from someone labeled as enemy. That commitment to maintaining the memory is the kind of honor that transforms death into reconciliation and creates authentic peace. I can't tell you something about all 1.3 million people killed in combat through our nation's history. All I can say is that each of them had a life that went beyond fatigues and marches and being prepared to shoot. We can't know how they would have contributed to the world had they lived. We owe our war dead honor. And the final way to honor them is to avoid being carried away with war fever, but to examine options and do all we can to preserve peace on the rare occasions it comes. What President Obama said of the dead in Hiroshima could be said of all the soldiers who have died through the centuries, our own soldiers and those from other places. He said, "Those who died, they are like us." Ordinary people understand this, I think. They do not want more war. They would rather that the wonder of science be focused on improving life and not eliminating it. When the choice is made by nations, when the choice is made by leaders, reflect this simple wisdom, then the lesson of Hiroshima is done. "We shall not repeat the evil," reads the memorial arch at the Peace Park in Hiroshima. May it be so. We have some time if you have questions or comments that you'd like to offer.
Hello, Sabrina Boker. I want to make a comment on what the effect of war has on people. If anybody's ever seen StoryCorps, they do they record things. There was a World War I soldier who was on the line, and there was a young German coming up towards the line. He yelled for him to surrender, but the German brought up his weapon, so he shot the guy, which was understandable because it was either him or the guy. But he dreamed about that soldier every day for the rest of his life. So I thought, you know, wars, and also, you're right about the suicides. There's so many suicides in the for the veterans and all that. And we had the suicide line, hotline. It turns out some people were getting recordings because they didn't have enough people to staff it. So they're trying to fix that problem right now. But, yeah, it's a big problem. So thank you.
A couple people have asked about the shirt and why I chose to dress the way I did today. I chose to dress this way because it is in keeping with our service today. But I wear a 4th Battalion, 23rd Infantry Regiment, Tomahawks t-shirt in memory of the 11 brothers that I lost in Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010, and the 7 brothers I lost when we went back in 2012 and 2013. They are my Memorial Day. I don't just remember them this Monday every year. Those of us that go to war and we fight with our friends and we go to these combat situations, and not all of us come back, we remember them every day. We see them when we close our eyes. We see them when we look in the mirror. We see them every time we put on our uniform. So on Memorial Day, at least for me, don't thank me. Thank the 18 brothers that I had to leave in the sands of Afghanistan.
Let's see, I wanted to recall Doreen Chanteau, who was the vice chair here and the first one to start a Memorial Day service about 15 years ago. She died in 2008. And she had served in the Vietnam conflict as a nurse.
Thank you.
One of the things to remember is the families of those that have died, and that they continue to remember their loved ones. We have a unique opportunity in this area that K-State has a professor over in human ecology that runs a center that involves itself mostly with the families of military veterans, offers a lot of public events, not a lot actually, a few each year, and it keeps their plight kind of out in the open and public for everyone, which is a nice thing. I mean, obviously we're adjacent to Fort Riley, so that helps, but remember all those families out there too.
Segueing off of family, I would like to read the ending bit from the movie Black Hawk Down. It's a very touching letter. It's known as a death letter. It's something that a soldier carries with him in case not so good things happen. He wrote this to his wife. My love, you are strong and will do well in life. I love you and my children deeply. Today and tomorrow, let each day grow and grow. Keep smiling and never give up, even when things get you down. So in closing, my love, tonight, tuck my children into bed warmly. Tell them I love them. Then hug them for me and give them a kiss goodnight for Daddy.
Pat Embersett, many of you have probably seen the Manhattan Mercury this morning on the front page with these two people that were 98 years old at Via Christi that found that they were in the same battle in Burma, I believe, Burmese battle. And it just struck me, the article is really worth reading. It has to do with the fact that this was a battle that hardly was recognized, and that many people died in the jungle, and it was truly awesome that these two people met after 98 years, after not, you know, 70 years that this happened, and were able to talk about this. It really affected me.
All right, I'll close with words from UU Minister Barbara Peskin. Bless the poets and those who mourn. Send peace for the soldiers who did not make the wars but whose lives were consumed by them. Let strong trees grow above graves far from home. Breathe through the arms of their branches. The earth will swallow your tears, while the dead sing no more, never again. Remember me. For the wounded ones and those who received them back, let there be someone ready when the memories come, when the scars pull and the buried metal moves, and forgiveness for those of us who were not there for our ignorance. And in us, veterans in a forest of 1,000 fallen promises, let new leaves of protest grow on our stumps. Give us courage to answer the cry of humanity's pain, and with our bare hands, out of full hearts, with our intelligence, let us create peace. Our closing hymn is number 107. Now sing we of the brave of old. I invite you to stand as you're willing and able. May the peace which passes under all understanding, which the world can neither take nor give. Be among us and abide in our hearts always.